Salute.
Have
peace.
A blessed night.
All right.
Thank you.
Peace. Rebel Diaz Radio. This is your boy Rod Stars.
John Mega.
Yamir Chubar.
Salute. Thank you for tuning in every Wednesday, 10 p.m. to midnight. WBI 99.5. Much love for everybody tuning in and giving us your time and your ears. Peace out, y'all.
Peace, New York.
Peace.
Hi, I'm Elia.
And I'm Barika.
We're your tour guides for the upcoming Arts and Culture two-day tour in D.C. on February 25th and 26th for WBAI listeners and friends.
This overnight tour is packed with delicious dinners, a relaxing stay at the NBC Row Hotel, plus special surprises along the way. And of course, we will visit two art museums and an entire day at the brand new National Museum of African American History and Culture.
Wait a second, but doesn't it take months on a wait list to get those tickets, Barika?
Well, Elia, we've got everybody covered with special entrance tickets. So mark your calendars for February 25th through the 26th and reserve your tickets today for this weekend tour.
So visit WBAI.org. Tickets are limited and going quickly.
Museums, transportation, lodging, and dinner. Plus, the entire trip is tax deductible.
Visit WBAI.org to RSVP your spot today. Enjoy your trip to D.C.
Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry. He was called a racist, his impartiality called into question, but Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, the senator from Alabama, was confirmed tonight as U.S. Attorney General. The vote 50-46. Then it went to Alaska Senator Republican Lisa Murkowski.
Ms. Murkowski, aye.
The final tally, 52-47.
Are there any senators in the chamber wishing to change their vote? If not, the ayes are 52, the nays are 47. And I'm sorry? And one senator responded present. The nomination is confirmed. Majority Leader.
I move to reconsider the vote on the
nomination. We have order.
I move to reconsider the vote.
Question is on the motion to be reconsidered.
I move to table the motion to reconsider.
The question is on the motion to table. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no.
I ask unanimous consent.
The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The motion is agreed to.
I ask unanimous consent the mandatory quorum call be waived.
Is there objection? Without objection.
Sessions won unanimous backing from Senate Republicans, and he picked up support of one Democrat, Joe Manchin of West Virginia. The vote capped weeks of divisive battles over Sessions, an early supporter of President Donald Trump and one of the Senate's most conservative lawmakers. Critics say Sessions wouldn't do enough to protect voting rights of minorities, protect LGBTQ and the legal rights of women. There's concern immigrants in the country illegally won't receive due process with Sessions as the top law enforcement officer. In response, Common Cause says we need Americans of conscience to hold Jeff Sessions accountable every step of the way. Common Cause says while 52 U.S. senators may have caved in to political expedience and fear of Trump retribution, we the people are not about to quit. Now that Jefferson Beauregard Sessions is the Attorney General, he must be watched. So Common Cause is launching Sessions Watch. Go to commoncause.org to sign up. Richard Cohen of the Southern Poverty Law Center says we oppose Sessions' nomination because of his record on civil rights and his association with extremist anti-immigrant organizations. Now that he has been confirmed as our next Attorney General, we hope he surprises us and his other critics by protecting the civil and human rights of all persons in our country. Given the xenophobic executive orders that have been coming out of the White House, we need a staunch defender of the Constitution at the Justice Department. Linda Perry, Perry, WBAI News, New York, 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 York.
Hi, this is David Amram. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 on your FM dial, and keep on listening.
This is Law and Disorder.
Good morning and welcome to a very special morning edition of Law and Disorder. I'm Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Michael Smith. Nice to see you, Heidi. Nice to see you, Michael G.
Great to be here.
And on a great day because it follows on the heel of that tremendous victory over the Trump's illegal, unconstitutional, immoral banning of visitors and refugees to our country.
It was certainly an impressive response from people all across the country, especially here in New York at JFK Airport. And as Michael said, the good news is that the judge has done the right thing, even though our newly elected president is now calling those judges so-called judges and really demeaning the rule of law. But that's why we're here, to tell you about the laws and practices that in some cases have been repressive over the last decade plus.
But this is a tremendous victory, and our show is about that. We're going to interview King Downing, who's the head of the Mass Defense Committee for the National Lawyers Guild, who helped organize the tremendous protest at the airport. And we're going to interview Lizzie Ratner, Michael Ratner's niece, the senior editor at The Nation, who wrote a devastating article against Jared Kushner, because it turns out Lizzie Ratner's family got here in 1920, just before they changed the law, preventing Jews and Catholics, people from Eastern and Southern Europe, from coming here. And Jared Kushner's grandmother didn't get out, and Lizzie tells that story. So we've got interviews with both King Downing and Lizzie Ratner, but we've got a premium.
Michael, I think today's premium is especially relevant given what is going on. We have the book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, that you are one of the editors of with Francis Golden and Debbie Smith. And we've had 9 of the contributors in this wonderful compendium have been guests on Law and Disorder over the last couple of years. But why I love this book, Michael, is that it presents a blueprint of an alternate way of life in this country.
Well.
And we need that now.
Yeah, the first part, which is the easiest part, is to criticize capitalism. We can all do that. But the second part shows, and there are 30 contributions from people like Michael Ratner, Arun Gupta, Ajamu Baraka, Angela Davis, Mumia Abu-Jamal. The second part, the 30 chapters, shows about how everything could be different if we didn't have capitalism. And the third part of the book shows and how we can get from where we are to where we want to be. The book's called Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. We want to give it out to you for $50. That's one of our premiums. Heidi, what are the other premiums?
Well, if you make the contribution of $50, we'll send you that book. We can also add, for another $35 contribution, Law and Disorder Archives for 3 years, 2014 to 2017, and we're calling that altogether the Imagine Pack. There's actually a discount. $75 gift will get you both of those. We also want to mention a special gift that the station has put together. It's called Voices That Change the World, Pacifica Archives on a flash drive. How convenient is that? A gift of $250 will send that to your house.
It's the most comprehensive and largest collection of historic audio ever compiled by Pacifica Radio Archives, and it's 1,000 hours. It's just magnificent stuff. If you can come up with $250, we'd like to send it to you.
But wait, if you can come up with $300, we'll send you Voices That Change the World and Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. So you'll be listening for months and reading for weeks and getting really inspired. The number to call, Michael, let's just remind people, is 516-620-3602. Now, you and I are just on for 55 more minutes, and we need to raise a lot of money this morning.
Yeah, we do. You know, this station, an independent newspaper, Pacifica generally, we're all in the crosshairs of Bannon and Trump. Don't kid yourself. What they'd really like to do is shut down their critics. If Trump one day can call a judge his order ridiculous, and the judge, a so-called judge, the next day they can come after the media that criticizes him. We've got to keep the station going. WBAI gave us our start. We're now on 100 stations across the country.
I think we're on a little more now. We've gotten a few new ones. Yeah,
we picked up Fairbanks, Alaska.
Right, we passed the mark.
Anyway, we need your support, folks. Please, now's the time to come to aid of your station. I just wanted to reflect on the tremendous victory we had over Trump's illegal and immoral anti-Muslim, anti-people from seven different predominantly Muslim countries, the ban. The governor of the state of Washington, we got a lot of people on our side. He was out at the airport and outside of Seattle,
right,
as was the attorney general out there. The governor gave a press conference. He denounced what Trump did, and he said not only what they did is so cruel, he said, but they couldn't even roll it out right. He said these people couldn't organize a two-car funeral.
Well, I think that's exactly what we're seeing on a number of fronts, Michael. Hastily enacted, ill-advised, and often unconstitutional policies, because in his first 10 to 14 days, this man wants to show that he's enacting change. But it's creating not only chaos in the streets and the airports, as we've seen, but his own administration is complaining that without consulting with the proper individuals, the mechanisms are a mess. He's not lining it up, you know, with any forethought or care for the many different details that you need to look at. So I think this is sloppiness personified. And the only good news, I think, Michael, is that it accentuates how really thoughtless this man is. He's big on talk, but doesn't really know how to impact meaningful change. Even if it's change we don't like, he's bad at it.
He wasn't a good business executive. He ran his businesses into the ground.
Right.
He could have made more money if he'd just invested in the stock market. And he's not a good president. More than that, and this was interesting, I read over the weekend, the American Psychological Association, which heretofore had been banned of making diagnosis of people without examining them.
Right.
And they couldn't stand it any longer. And 1,100 of them came out and they said the guy's crazy. They said that he's a
malignant. Is that the word they use?
No, they use the word. My friend Joel Covell, who used to teach psychiatry, he's a professor and an MD, he uses the word bonkers. But they use the word malignant narcissist. And
oh, I like that.
That's what's
so
scary, because you can't reason with people like this. He doesn't appreciate reality.
I would also add to that infectious malignant narcissist, because unfortunately it's spreading to those around him.
Anyway, the ban has been overturned, and the government would like to get it reinstated. I'm not sure they're going to be able to do that.
Well, they're filing their briefs now, I believe.
They're filing their brief today.
Yep.
And it's really almost unprecedented to appeal a TRO, a temporary restraining order, which is what they're doing, to the Court of Appeals. Now, I would guess that the Court of Appeals is going to uphold the judge below, and the ban is going to so then they're going to have to get to the Supreme Court. But they're going to have to get to the Supreme Court later, when they can stack it with this new guy,
right,
Gorsuch.
Right.
Whether they can do that, I don't know. So this is a historic defeat for Trump, and we want to celebrate that.
We do. Let's hope it's just the beginning of historic defeats. But I think it's appropriate if we go to listen to King Downing.
Let's hear him.
Because he was helping organize those people on the streets. This is King Downing from the National Lawyers Guild. He's the head of their mass defense efforts.
As confusion spread quickly last week over Trump's executive order to temporarily block refugees and deny entry to citizens from seven majority Muslim countries, protesters converged on airports across the nation. Defense attorneys set up shop in airport waiting areas as Customs and Border Protection officials detained legal permanent residents and visa holders while denying them access to counsel. Attorneys general from 16 states condemned the order, and National Lawyers Guild legal observers and defense attorneys were on full alert, rushing to monitor police activity at airports across the United States. Joining us for an update on this rapid response is the Guild's National Mass Defense Director, King Downing. Previously, King directed the Healing Justice Program of the American Friends Service Committee, where he worked on mass incarceration, including solitary confinement, prisoner advocacy, and conflict resolution. He is also the former national coordinator of the ACLU's Campaign Against Racial Profiling, which worked to identify and end stop and frisk, including the school-to-prison pipeline and other police abuse tactics. King Downing, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me here. I followed the show for the longest time. My condolences around Michael Ratner. That was a big loss. But I'm also so happy to hear that you all have just spread all over the country, which is going to make my work easier because I'm going to tell people in our chapters, wherever they are, that they need to tune in. So I need to get that full list.
Fabulous. King, you and I took part in a National Lawyers Guild Legal Observer training last week as protesters were rushing to JFK Airport here in New York. How much advance notice did you have, and how did the Guild chapters rally to meet this countrywide challenge?
And I'd like to jump into that, but if you don't mind, just for a second, just to give a little background. I know you've talked about the Guild a lot, but the Mass Defense Program and the committee go back to 1968 here in New York, the Columbia protests. Maybe you all have some close stories that follow that. But it was out of that that this whole program was set up in the committee to try to address this problem all around the country through the chapters. Now, it's a little bit sort of proprietary how much advance notice we get about these issues. But what we will say is that we have a great reputation with organizations, and they contact us just generally, hypothetically, when things are planning to happen.
Tell us, I didn't make it to the airport. What kind of police presence was there? And was the Port Authority the primary agency in charge here in New York?
The reports that we got were that it was primarily the NYPD, and that there was a stand down, although that doesn't change our general opinion of how the NYPD has policed in communities. But in this case, they did stand down, and there was a strong presence, but I can't say I wasn't there, so I don't know what kind of numbers there were.
How do you account for the stand down, King?
I don't know. I've been asked this a few times, and I've kind of taken a shorthand answer because I was at an event that Charles Barron was at, and he was saying after the election that because of the change in regime that you were going to see a lot of people who had been polishing up their resumes for jobs in Washington now out on the protest lines. So that's a shorthand way of saying that a lot of people who were institutionalized when the Democrats were in power are now also upset with what the regime is doing. And so I have a sense that the mayor, who probably because of the position on sanctuary cities, agrees. And so I think that there were a good number. I mean, I've got the Guild was involved in, I think my count was 14 of our chapters reported that they had a legal presence at airports. And at almost all of them, the police had taken a low-key perspective. And I think I got a total of maybe 15 arrests that we've been able to confirm. There may have been more, but 13 in Seattle and 2 in Minneapolis.
That's astonishing.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
And when you say stand down, what did that mean with respect to protesters get out there? They didn't get vamped on. I mean, what happened?
Well, it seemed that the police, and I just speaking generally across all the airports, that the police were, I don't know, tolerant of people standing and chanting and moving around and kept an eye on them. And there were places where we got reports that people were blocked from going certain areas, but it wasn't get them all out the way we see on the street.
So there were no less lethal weapons.
I can't speak on what happened at the West Coast where there were the 13 arrests,
right,
but at least the kind of actions, we didn't get any reports of them going into crowds and spraying and beating people and pulling people out.
Riot gear, et cetera.
Yeah.
Good,
yeah.
Good. King, what kind of, well, there weren't that many arrests. What kind of legal defense did the Guild provide?
Well, I know in the case of the only places where we did have arrests were Minneapolis and Seattle, that the Guild is involved, were there as legal observers, had lawyers on the scene, and we'll have more developments as time comes up.
You were in D.C. recently for the inauguration protest. What happened down there? Was that a different scene?
Everything happened. Everything happened. There were some things that the chapters expected, and there were some things that the chapters didn't expect. One of the things that we expected was that there were going to be people down there who were determined not to let people get into the inauguration or the parades. That's the kind of things we were hearing. We had contact with organizations like Disrupt J20, which was one of the larger organizers. We met with them, did a Know Your Rights workshop at the church where their activities were being held. But D.C. had, you know, I want to use the legal term, had been legally spanked by litigation earlier around the G8 protest in 2002, where they had kettled people and done all sorts of things that were unconstitutional and settled the number I heard was about a $14 million.
Yes, that's right.
$14 million lawsuit that from now on they were going to give three warnings, not kettle, distinguish.
Warnings to disperse.
Warnings to disperse. And so everything was running pretty smoothly. I was a legal observer coordinator for the Black Lives Matter protest, which turned into a blockade of an exit. We thought that was going to be a hot spot, and the police basically took a no hands position and just allowed the entrance to be closed. And I guess we're diverting people to other places. So it went pretty much without incident. What did finally happen as I got back to the office after these events ended was that there had been a large kettling at 12th and L, and that's been the area of a lot of drama now. We're not sure exactly how it developed, but at some point when we got back, we got reports that hundreds of people had been kettled and were being held there for hours and hours.
Kettled means being surrounded.
Being surrounded by police.
And then arrested.
Well, for a long time, they were just being held there. In fact, I know at some point we're going to talk about innovations, but one of the innovations that I had suggested when I went down there that was very successful in Cleveland was the use of bicycle legal observers so that we could have people planted in geographic areas. And then if those areas were quiet, then they could just get on the bikes and move to the hotspots. And it went pretty well. So we had a couple of bicycles available, but we sent one lawyer by bicycle down to the kettle to try to negotiate with the police. Why are these people being held for hours, not able to go to the bathroom, not able to get any food? And when they finally started arresting them, the reports that we've gotten were that they were arresting one person every 15 minutes. They were just letting this drag on and drag on.
That's an interesting tactic. I've got to observe, King, that great innovation. A little late, given that in 2004 the NYPD was deploying police on bicycles. It's brilliant to have legal observers on them as well. But I wonder why it took us so long.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I got here in March, and we put this in place in June. So I don't know.
Innovation.
But see, it came from my experiences doing Cop Watch.
Right.
And so we had done it by vehicle, and it just seemed that the next step, because our vehicles were getting stopped at the lights when the police drove through, ran the red light. So we thought, well, maybe bicycles are next. I said, well, let's try it at the Guild.
And if you'd like to hear about more innovations in the field of legal observing, stay tuned. We may be playing some more from King Downing's interview, but you can also get it online on lawanddisorder.org. Now, this is a fundraising hour with Michael Smith and Heidi Boghossian, representing Law and Disorder. The number to call is 516-620-3602. And today we have an appropriate gift to send you if you make a donation of $50 or more. And it's Michael Smith's book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. Now, Michael, how did you get the idea for this wonderful compendium?
Well, I'm a co-editor of the book. I also wrote a chapter on what law could be like if we got rid of capitalism. But the other co-editors are Debbie Smith and Francis Golden, the famous literary agent. Francis is 92 years old. It was her idea. She said, you know, there were three things I want to do in my life. I did one. I stopped Robert Moses from putting an expressway through the Lower East Side, and I'm working on getting Mumia Abu-Jamal out of prison. And I want to do a book on what a socialist America would look like, and I want you and Debbie to help me. And we did. And a lot of the authors in the book are people that we had had on the radio show. Rick Wolf wrote a chapter called The Shape of Post-Capitalist Future. Angela Davis and Mumia wrote a chapter called Alternatives to the Present System of Capitalist Injustice. Michael Ratner wrote a chapter on what he would do if he was the attorney general. And he starts off saying it'd be a cold day in hell if a person with my politics is appointed as attorney general. Arun Gupta wrote one on food for all, creating a socially responsible and sustainable food system. Imagine Art After Capitalism, Matt Callahan, Teaching Freedom, Bill Ayers, and on and on. 31 chapters altogether about how everything could be different. So Frances, I said to her, Frances, I don't know, you know, I guess we should get some small left-wing publisher. Who's going to publish a book like this? And she said, I don't want a small publisher. I want a major publisher. So she went to Oxford Press, and they wrote back and said, we can't do it because your book isn't balanced. And Frances said, what do you mean balanced? You want me to put half the book on about fascism? So that guy wasn't available. And so next she went to HarperCollins. I was really dubious about HarperCollins. You know why, Heidi? You know who owns HarperCollins? Rupert Murdoch, the demon. And she submits the book to them, and they call her up, and they say, we can't do it because it won't sell enough. And she said, let me remind you of something. I gave you the second best-selling book in history next to the Bible, Goodnight Moon, the children's book. And I gave you Barbara Kingsolver, the great author. And I want you to do this book. So they called her back and they said, well, we've reconsidered and we want you to come up to the office. So Frances and Debbie and I go up to the office and we go meet with Richard Bingham, the executive vice president, to talk about a contract. And he's one of those people that's got the corner office, which looks like a living room. You know, there's not just a desk. There's a table and chairs. There's a couch. And on the couch are two pillows. I walk in. Frances is with me. She's got a sign on her back that says, tax the rich. She either wears that sign or another sign that says, I love my two lesbian daughters. Anyway, Frances and Debbie and I walk in. I look at the couch. I see a pillow with a drawing of Queen Elizabeth. And my heart sunk. And then I look over to the other side of the couch, and there's another pillow with a drawing of Karl Marx. So I say to Mr. Bingham, this is an auspicious beginning. And he says, what's your definition of socialism? And I say, it's not just political democracy, it's economic democracy. And he says, will you take a $10,000 advance? And I said, yes, if you use the money and publicize this book for us. And he promised he would do that, and sure enough, Frances was right, because getting a major publisher like HarperCollins, we got on C-SPAN, on, you know, Book News, Heidi, that and the book launch, which we had at Housing Works, which had about 300 people there, was broadcast all over the country, and the book sold like crazy.
Well, Michael, let's talk about an important part of the book. So we really want people to call in, make a donation to support WBAI, and we'll send you this book. The last section is called Getting There, How to Make a Socialist America. So in a way, you provided a roadmap written by several people. As you've mentioned, our own Michael Ratner, let's see, Clifford D. Connor, Diane Feeley, Paul LeBlanc. I like that because in addition to, it's not just a theoretical book, it's a practical primer.
Exactly. The chapters, just to give you a feel for it, Kazembe Balogun wrote, we be reading Marx, Where We Come From, Socialism and the Black Freedom Struggle. Michael Zweig wrote The Working Class Majority. Cliff Connor wrote one on how to achieve economic democracy in the United States. And Paul LeBlanc, the great historian, wrote one, The Third American Revolution, How Socialism Had Come to the United States. He talks about the first, you know, 1776 and the second American Civil War, but how we can have a true democracy here. And then there's this wonderful poem by the Puerto Rican poet Martina Espada, Imagine the Angels of Bread. So we not only talk about how things would be different, but how you can get from here to where we want to be.
I want to read just a couple of sentences from Frances Golden's preface. She says, but a better world is possible, and if we are to win any measure of justice in our country, we must all take responsibility for working toward it. As the drums beat for more wars, there is an alternative. Give the power back to the working people, or risk turning into a barbaric fascist state. And then she ends by saying, it's not a dream. It can be done if the people struggle to replace rapacious capitalism with life-enhancing socialism. And I think now more than ever, those words really resonate with an urgency that everyone must take action in whatever way possible. And there are many ways, from donating to a new cause, going to the streets, writing to your local representatives. But we have to take ownership.
Yeah. Times like this, extremely dangerous times, are also simultaneously times of opportunity. And that's what we wanted this book to be, so people could explain that we have hope and that there's somewhere to go. Because if we don't put out an alternative to what the Trump people are trying to do, you know, we're screwed. $50 for the book, Voices That Changed the World, $250, 1,000 hours from the Pacifica Radio Archives, $250 for that. The Imagine book, along with the 2014 to 2017 Law and Disorder programs, 3 years of our programs, is $35. Together with the Imagine book, it's $75. So please call 516-620-3602. We've got to keep the station on the air. This is our voice. This is something that the Trump people are going to target. I can promise you that. And we need your help. We'd like to send you Imagine Living in a Socialist USA for your support.
And we have wonderful volunteers donating their time to take your calls. Let's not leave them sitting there. Let's give them something to do. 516-620-3602. We have 1 hour on the air with Michael Smith, Heidi Boghossian, Law and Disorder. Our program's been running 14 years, I think.
Yeah, yeah. The only program in the country where you've got attorneys interviewing mostly other attorneys about law and social change.
But we also interview activists, authors, people really on the front lines of making social change in this country. We wouldn't be able to do that on any other station. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, we've got coming up Lizzie Ratner to continue our program about the Muslim ban and the ban on immigrants, because Lizzie's family barely got here. Gerard Kushner, his family didn't. And she tells the story and shows the hypocrisy of Kushner and his extended family, including Donald Trump and his wife. So we want to play that for you. Heidi, did you have something you wanted to say?
No, just telling people that we're waiting for the lines to light up so that we can see you're listening, you're interested, and that you care about this station. Really, it's the center for honesty in news reporting. And we know that the First Amendment is under attack, that we already have a conglomeration of corporate owned media, just a few outlets owned by the same entities. And we think that this new presidential administration would like nothing more than to monitor closely independent media and to shut it down at every chance that it gets.
So with that, you're not going to hear this on any other radio station. We're playing the interview we did with Michael Ratner's niece, Lizzie Ratner. She wrote an article in The Nation called Nobody Wanted to Take Us In, the story of Jared Kushner's family and mine.
Last week, President Trump barred entrance to refugees and visitors from the predominantly Muslim countries of Iran, Sudan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Yemen, and Libya, inspiring outrage and acts of solidarity. The conservative Cato Institute showed in a recent study that there were exactly zero terrorist attacks committed by people from these countries from the years 1975 to 2015. Last year alone, some 700 people died falling out of bed. Open immigration to the United States was cut off in 1920 by de facto religious quotas, excluding people from Eastern and Southern Europe, that is, Jews and Catholics. At that time, half of the world's Jews, some 3 million people, lived in Poland, and millions more in the surrounding areas. Those who did not escape were soon to perish in fascist death camps. Ray Kushner, Jared Kushner's grandmother, lost half her family when most of the 6,000 Jews in her town in northern Poland were killed. She escaped, hiding for a year in the woods, and then she was kept in a displaced person camp, like a refugee camp. And finally, in 1948, she was allowed into the United States. Our guest, Lizzie Ratner's family, escaped from Bialystok, Poland, and came to Cleveland in 1920, just before the quotas could exclude them. She recently wrote an article for The Nation magazine, where she is a senior editor, on the fate of her family and that of the Kushners. Jared Kushner is Donald Trump's son-in-law and an advisor. Lizzie Ratner is Michael Ratner's niece.
Lizzie Ratner, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. It means a ton to be on with you and Michael right now.
Oh, thank you. You recently wrote an article for The Nation titled, Nobody Wanted to Take Us In, The Story of Jared Kushner's Family and Mine. Please tell us what happened to your grandfather, Harry Ratner, who was Michael Ratner's father.
Well, the story of Harry Ratner, also known as Asher Radofsir, is one of enormous good luck and enormous good timing. Harry was one of nine children who was born in Bialystok, what is now Poland, but what was which was Russia when he was born in Germany during World War One. In 1920, his oldest brother, who had gone to the United States 14 years earlier, came back and said to the family, "You got to get out of here." It was an incredibly hard time in Bialystok at that point. Poland and the Soviet Union were fighting. The First World War had just ended. Life was hard and bad for Jews. There were pogroms. The family decided that they were going to leave and go to the United States. My grandpa Harry, though, had a problem, which was that he was of conscription age for the Polish army, which was not a happy place for Jews and really for anybody, I suspect, who was being conscripted into the army. And so in order to leave Poland, he had to sneak out. He could not leave legally. So he and one of his older brothers, who was also of conscription age, they dressed up as farmers and cattle herders. They snuck out of Poland and into the sort of what was then the free city of Danzig, which is now Gdansk. And the first time my grandfather tried to sneak out, he was actually caught by a bunch of German border guards. He was hiding in a haystack overnight after having crossed out of Poland. He was caught. He was sent back to Poland. He tried again. He got out successfully. But once he was in Danzig, he had another problem. He had forged passports. And the sort of family story goes that because he had these forged passports, he was not eligible for a visa to the United States, for a visa, they called it at the time. His older brother, my great uncle Kalman, who was the one who had gone to the United States and said, "You guys, you got to get out of Poland," he basically interceded, the story goes, with the American consul in Germany. They were both Freemasons, which is sort of a wild and crazy story. And apparently my great uncle worked some Freemason magic and managed to get my grandfather approved for travel to the United States. So this is all a lot of wind up to say that my grandfather's journey to this country was not assured. And if his timing had been different, things would have been very, very bad possibly for him, because my grandfather arrived in October 1920. In May 1921, the United States passed really the second in a series of three draconian anti-immigrant acts, acts that were intended to really limit immigration first from pretty much all of Asia, which is shocking. You heard that right, almost all of Asia. Also, the sort of xenophobes who were controlling Congress at the time really wanted to limit immigration of Jews, Catholics, Eastern Europeans, Southern Europeans. So they passed these extreme measures. The second one in 1921 imposed a quota system. And the quota system made it significantly harder for lots of people from Eastern Europe to get to the United States, including Jews like my family. So all of this is a long way of saying my family got here about 6 months before the borders really started to close. Now, this is significant, we now know, historically, because once the borders closed in the 1920s, they remained closed for well over 20 years.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you about, Lizzie. You know, with Trump, we're now witnessing the revival of an anti-immigrant regime. Mm-hmm. And what kind of anti-immigrant fervor was created in the 20s that caused them to close down those borders?
That's a great question. And the answer is an interesting one, because as I was researching my article, what I noticed was that there's enormous similarity, rhetorically as well as in some ways politically, between the late 19-teens and early 20s, when the United States closed its borders, and this moment now. So let's pause before we even get into the rhetoric. Let's look at the history a little bit. This was a moment which was politically quite similar, or had some, you know, notable similarities to today. It was sort of the end of the First World War, which was a moment which created numerous refugees in Europe and Eastern Europe. People who were desperate to get out and go to a place where there wasn't war, where they would have a home and there wasn't hunger. In addition, there was the Russian Revolution, and so you had the rise of communism, which really freaked out people in the United States. And so there was actually, in 1919, the first Red Scare. We're really familiar with the second Red Scare that happened in the 1950s, but there was a preview to that ugly moment in 1919 when there was a initial Red Scare, and people in this country became very scared of immigrants in particular who would come over from Russia and would be stealth Bolsheviks, stealth communists, and try to turn the country red from the inside. There was also a big fear of anarchists. So that was part of the fear of Italian anarchists like Sacco and Vanzetti who would come here and wreak havoc. It was also sort of the rise of the eugenics movement, a flourishing moment for eugenics. So there was this racism.
That was Lizzie Ratner, and if you liked what you heard, that's part of an interview that Michael Smith and I did recently with Lizzie. If you like that, please support WBAI. We need you to call in, make a generous contribution. We have volunteers waiting to take your call. The number is 516-620-3602. We're giving away, as a gift of appreciation, the book Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, and I'd like to pause for a second and ask you to imagine what it would be like to live in New York City without WBAI on the air. I think it would be quite different. It would be reliance on corporate-owned media. You wouldn't hear the kind of stories that we bring to you each week on Law and Disorder with guests who are really in the trenches doing social justice work, giving a perspective that you don't hear in the mainstream media. That's why we want you to support WBAI. 516-620-3602. Our volunteers are happy to make any arrangement that you want to spread your gift out over time. We'll take your credit card. Please call. We need your donation now.
And for $50, we'd like to send you Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, a book that I co-edited. Chris Hedges, who's been on our show several times, wrote about the book, and this is what I want to try to convey to you, why we did this book, and I'm going to talk for a bit on also what's in it. But Chris wrote, throughout history, those who have sought radical social change have always had to first discredit the ideas used to prop up ruling elites and construct alternative ideas for society. The articulation of a viable socialism as an alternative to corporate tyranny is, for me, paramount. Once ideas shift for a large portion of the population, once the vision of a new society grips the popular imagination, the old regime is finished. That is why Imagine Living in a Socialist USA is an important contribution in promoting revolutionary ferment and consciousness. And that's what we tried to do in this book. We have chapters that would demonstrate to you how socialism would change everything: housing, medicine, food, education, sexuality, women's work, emotional life, welfare, art, science, technology, law, media, immigration, the black freedom struggle. And we talk about the shape of a post-capitalist economy and how a democratically run economy would work. And we conclude with several chapters on ecology and eco-socialism. That's in the book. It's $50. Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. You can get it by calling 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Heidi?
We're also offering a special flash drive called Voices That Change the World from the Pacific Archives. And I haven't heard this, Michael, but it sounds really wonderful. For the first time on one memory drive, it's nearly 1,000 hours of really well-curated audio covering literally dozens and dozens of topics. I think now more than ever, we need to look back through the years to successes in history, to similar challenges and how we confronted them. And what better place to look back than through the WBAI archives?
You know, it's really a history from the progressive point of view of intellectual and social and moral ideas for the last 50 years. Noam Chomsky, Alice Walker, Allen Ginsberg, Adrian Rich, June Jordan, Gore Vidal, Langston Hughes, Jessica Mitford, Lena Horne, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Rosa Parks, Huey Newton, Paul Robeson, Nelson Mandela, Billie Holiday, John Coltrane, Emma Goldman, Alice Walker, Lily Tomlin, Betty Davis. It's just amazing what's in here. It's $250. It's a stretch, we know, but if you can do it, we need your help, and we'll send you this wonderful Voices That Change the World.
This fundraising drive, I think more than others, Michael, is more urgent given the climate that we're now living in. We never, speaking of imagine, never imagined that we would have Donald Trump as our commander-in-chief. I like to call him our tweeter-in-chief because he does that with his own panache, as it were. But the threats that all of our communities are facing, I think will bring people closer together, but it's dangerous, and everyone who's listening knows that. But I think that having WBAI on a daily basis to tune into, to get inspired, supported, to have ideas and guests who are really brave enough to take on some of these challenges firsthand, that's a community that is increasingly relevant right now.
Yeah, I'll say, you know, because of the crisis, all sorts of groups have been asking for money and getting it.
Yes.
The ACLU raised $24 million last weekend.
Yes.
Well, I'm sorry that that every organization that asked for money didn't each get $24 million, but because each one of them is important. But nothing is as unique as our own radio station, right in the middle of the FM dial. This radio station is an invaluable asset to the movement. The bad guys are gnashing their teeth, thinking, how can we destroy it? How can we get rid of it? How can we take it over? Well, they haven't succeeded in doing that.
No.
And our listeners have stood up for this station and kept it on the air, and we thank you for the continual support that you give in the station and Law and Disorder. We started this show almost 14 years ago. It's growing. It's nationwide. We want to keep it going. We want to send you the book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, for $50. If you'll call 516-620-3602, we can send you the Voices That Change the World of Pacifica Archives. We'll send you the 3 years of Law and Disorder for $35. We'll send you that and the Imagine book, the Imagine Pack, for $75. We need your help. We want to send you these wonderful gifts. So please call 516-620-3602. We've got another segment coming up. But before we get to that, Heidi wanted to say something.
I did.
You did?
Did I?
Well,
no.
Let's do it.
No, I wanted to say let's have a little more chat with King Downing, Mass Defense Director at the National Lawyers Guild. Let's talk about Trump. We expect a massive crackdown on the First Amendment protected activities. You've been involved in, as you say, Black Lives Matter and many other mass demonstrations nationally. What are your predictions, despite the positive observations you've just made? What do you think is going to be the state of protest in the next year or so?
Wow. You know, we don't even have to predict. When we saw what happened during the primaries, we already saw people engaged. So it's really easy to predict now there are going to be 4 years of protest, even election night and the night after, huge turnout. So it doesn't make me much of a genie. But a couple of things came to mind when you said that. And one was France Fanon said, each generation must, out of relative obscurity, determine its mission, fulfill it, or betray it. And so I've been thinking a lot about how this generation has already stepped up right out of the blocks before things went. And I don't think they're going to stop. And the other one I thought of was Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, said that if the people don't organize themselves, conditions will. And so we had a case here where the people organized themselves right away, and I think conditions are just going to lead to more and more and more organizing.
There's an old union saying that the boss is the best organizer.
Yeah,
and,
right.
Thank you, Trump. I'm concerned the organizations that come out of this and the demonstrations that come out of this might come under attack by these Trump people. There were signs of that at the rallies. Trump was encouraging, if you punch somebody, I'll get a lawyer to defend you. Remember that statement? One report I read was a group of bikers showed up at a rally with guns. I mean, what I'm concerned about is you know, that kind of development.
We've already been talking about that. We're on that. We're actually already putting together a plan to extend to, and it's a delicate situation because of the Guild's view about protesters. We're not going going to get in a position now where we're going to start collecting information on counter-protesters and turning it over to the police. But what we've come up with is that we're going to observe the counter-protest behavior. If we see any activity that crosses over the line to criminal, we are planning to collect that and turn it over to any defense lawyers who are representing people who got involved in those skirmishes on the organizer side or people who are filing civil claims. We're also putting a plan together that actually was already happening before all this started. And one example of it is in one of our states, we had gotten contacted by an abortion clinic where the counter-protesters were harassing the escorts who were bringing women into the clinic. And it was a new dimension for the Guild, and so we had a conversation about it, and we're still in talks. And the idea was that we would look for that kind of criminal behavior and not to begin to report it to the police, but also observe discriminatory treatment by the police based on the pro or anti-abortion position. And they were letting anti-abortion protesters drive their cars into areas where other people were blocked, letting their buses through when other people were being prevented from being there.
There are a lot of laws being passed in various, being proposed, not yet passed, in various state legislatures against demonstrators. One of the scary ones was out of North Dakota. You know what I'm talking about, King, where they proposed a law that allows motorists to drive into people who are protesting on the highway and not be prosecuted for actually running into somebody. What's your thoughts on that?
That is one of the most disgusting things that I've ever seen, to say that people who negligently hit protesters will not be found liable. And, you know, I can't remember right at the moment whether it talked about protesters or anybody on the highway going for gasoline. I think it was viewpoint based, yeah. So I think it's gonna fall.
It's a scary thing, but there are other sorts of laws that are being proposed also to limit protests.
Yeah, there were five of them, and just off the top of my head, because I've just been pulling them all down and collecting them. Blocking highway or economic activity, which is kind of interesting because Black Lives Matter is on the highway. Because when they stand out in front of the institutions who are denying their rights, they don't get any attention. When they march on the sidewalks, they don't. And even when they march on the streets in the cities, they don't get attention. So finally getting out to the highway, they do get paid attention, and they're raising counter-economic issues. So
that was King Downing, and if you'd like to hear more of what he was explaining, you'll have to tune into lawanddisorder.org, where all of our shows are posted, and they're also podcastable. We have a few minutes remaining in our one-hour fundraising special. I'm here with Michael Smith. We're giving away, as appreciation for your contributions to WBAI, the book Imagine, Living in a Socialist USA. And the number to call to make your donation is 516-620-3602. We just have about 12 minutes left. We're going to play a little more from our other guest, Lizzie Ratner. But first, we want to urge you, if you have not made a gift to support WBAI, please do so now. Today is the first day of our fund drive. We're happy to be one of the groups to launch it off, and it would mean a lot to us if you would show your love for the station by making a gift. We also are offering, if your gift is generous, Voices That Change the World. It's Pacifica Archives on a flash drive, and it's really a slice of history on social justice and social change and the people behind those actions coming to life on your own audio player. So that is a gift of $250 to the station. We know it's steep, but I think that it will give back in a multiplier effect, because this kind of radio station is needed more now than ever.
Voices That Change the World, $250. There's so much in here that it's hard to even describe it all. There are audio books, there's Grammy restored recordings. It's a fabulous collection. If you can possibly afford $250, please. But if you can't, but you can come up with $50, let us send you the Imagine book. Nine of the articles are written by people that we've had on the radio station. It's a blueprint from how to get from here, where we are now, to where we want to go. There's wonderful articles about how everything in this society would be different if we got rid of a capitalist organized society that has nothing for us except war and exploitation. It's Rosa Luxemburg said 100 years ago, it's socialism or barbarism, and we can certainly see that developing now. And this book is meant to counter that and give people an idea of where we can get to and give people some hope.
As we see the pendulum swinging more toward corporate and government control, really, we have no alternative but to get people out in the streets en masse. The number to call, 516-620-3602. I'd like to see the lines lighting up to show that you're calling. This is the last 10 minutes of our show, and it would really mean a lot to us if you'd call in and pledge to WBAI and also show a little respect for the show Law and Disorder. We've been on the air 14 years now. We still miss our former co-host, Michael Ratner, but we tried to do cover stories that we know that he would approve of and sort of carry his moral authority with us as we do that.
And the person in his family who has the same moral compass as Michael did is his niece, Lizzie Ratner. We interviewed
yes.
her for you, and we're going to end the show up with the last part of our interview where she talks about Jared Kushner and his family and his grandmother.
Let's go to that.
But, you know, the stopping of Jewish immigration from Europe was one of the most significant events of modern Jewish history. Mm-hmm. Jared Kushner must know that. His wife, the converted Jew Ivanka, must know that. His father-in-law must know that. What do you think will be the effect of closing our borders to Arabs and Muslims, people from the Middle East and people from Africa?
I mean, I think, you know, history teaches us, although I don't even think we need history. I think we just need to open our eyes now and look. But there are desperate people. There are 65 million refugees, the worst refugee crisis since the Second World War. People are desperate. And by closing our borders, you know, there are sort of two scenarios, and neither of them is pretty. One is that people aren't able to leave their countries and end up either, you know, suffering torment and torture or actual death. I mean, that's what happens to people when they are stuck in countries that are war-torn and dangerous. But the other scenario is, listen, we already have a lot of refugees who are in refugee camps, and they're not pleasant places. They're horrible places. And so by closing the borders, it means that people will suffer in refugee camps even longer. And yes, they might be alive. They might not be in Syria. They might not be sort of suffering Assad's bombs. But they are going to be in, you know, the cold and exposure and misery of refugee camps. And so, you know, again, we can look to history, and I would love to return to Jared Kushner's grandmother's story because she was essentially in a refugee camp for a period. But we can also just open our eyes to the present and say this is unconscionable.
Lizzie, why do you call Trump a pathologically cynical president?
I guess because he is clearly pathological. There is some sort of pathology at work in almost everything he seems to do. And the cynicism is that I think he is, I have no reason to doubt that he is xenophobic and racist, but I also think the cynicism is that he is also willing to use these sort of noxious ideas and the movements that support these noxious ideas to coalesce power, you know, and to sort of keep power. And he knows that he's riding these sort of ugly strains of anger and hate toward power. So I think, you know, very likely he believes this stuff, but I also think there's a utilitarian element on his part that recognizes that that this is all good for consolidating his power. So that's sort of what the cynicism is.
What have American Jewish organizations and leaders been saying about the Trump ban? There's an ancient Jewish commandment about loving your neighbor as yourself. Has this become relevant now?
Yeah, well, it's a real mix. You have a number of progressive organizations that have been speaking out and protesting and calling on Trump and calling on Jared Kushner and saying, you know, our people were the victims of the first, not the first, but one of the major closings of the borders in this country. And we have an obligation to welcome other people so that they don't have to suffer the fate that Jews suffered. So you have groups like Bend the Ark, Trua. You have obviously the wonderful Jewish Voice for Peace. You have a lot of synagogues. You have an excellent group named Hias, which is very interesting, and I'll tell you about that in a sec. But they're all coming out. You have 200 Jewish historians coming out and saying, you know, history and our history tells us this is wrong. But you also have a number of Jewish groups that have been completely silent, the more conservative Jewish groups, which have been perhaps pleased with the Trump administration's appointment of a conservative settler for ambassador, are sort of pleased with where they see things going on in Israel and don't, you know, aren't willing to critique Trump on this other stuff. So it's been a mixed bag, but I have been enormously inspired and pleased by the work I've seen from a number of Jewish groups, really vocal Jewish groups. And so I'd love to talk about Hayas, which is an organization that might very possibly be the oldest refugee resettlement organization in the world. And it's certainly the oldest Jewish one. It was started in 1881, Lower East Side of New York, as the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. And they were helping to resettle the first wave of Jewish immigrants that came to this country in the 1880s. And they were enormously active, really with Jewish refugee resettlement for the next 100 years. And they helped my family when we were on the boat, when my great aunts and uncles and grandfather were on the boat to this country, and when my family was actually, some of my relatives were quarantined on Ellis Island. They fed them, they helped them. They helped the Kushners when the Kushners, were in a displaced persons camp.
That was Lizzie Ratner in an interview that we recently aired on Law and Disorder, and it's available in its entirety, as all our shows are, on lawanddisorder.org. We just have 2 minutes left, Michael. 516-620-3602 is the number to call, and we want you to have a copy of Imagine Living in a Socialist USA.
It's a book that I edited along with Debbie Smith and Francis Golden. It's really, and I don't mean to blow my own horn, but it's really quite a unique book. Paul Buell, the American historian, says it's the best, most insightful, and most lively work on socialism to appear in a long time. And we want you to have that. We offer it for $50. Usually our premiums are more. And we took a risk here in not raising our assigned goal to get this book out to you, because I think it's so important in organizing the movement where we stand now. Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, $50. 516-620-3602. You can get archives of our program for the last 3 years for $35. You can get both the book and the archives for $75. And if you're unusually well-heeled, we want to send you Voices That Changed the World. It's over 1,000 hours of Pacifica archives. It's fantastic. It's $250, but if you can make that stretch, please do. You'll help the station, and you'll help our program. It's WBAI Law and Disorder. We're brought to you every Monday morning at 9 o'clock. This is our special. We launched the fundraising drive with our program this month. Please call 516-620-3602. Tell us you're out there and that you're supporting the station and Law and Disorder.
Now more than ever, I think you all know that the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of the press is more imperiled than ever under this Trump administration. The whole rise of so-called fake news, well, BAI and Law and Disorder are committed to providing you with real news from people really doing the work to affect social justice and social change in this country.
And Law and Disorder was brought to you on recording. In case you couldn't tell, in case you weren't sure, you are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. We'll be right back. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. We are, A, on a fun to drive schedule, and B, after that, this will be the new time slot for Hour of the Wolf. We'll talk more in a while, but stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of
Whoops.
I'm going to take a wild guess
and
say
that
now
I have such a nice
science fiction film Beyond the Edge. To
register. Okay, you know what? We're gonna hear this again in just a moment. In just a little while. Oh, I had such a nice segue worked out.
Aliens.
Ah, there.
Register now.
Well, a little too late. The whole thing only runs, oh, you know, like 45 seconds or something. But it was supposed to sound like a bona fide, proper public service announcement telling all aliens to register. Really? It's from, I think it was on KPFK originally, on Dear Friends with the Fire Sign Theater many years ago. Oh, let's just play it from the start, shall we? Let's pretend that this is a proper public service announcement.
Aliens! Every year at this time, the National Space Administration requires all aliens to register. Forms are available at your local post office. Those without forms must appear, however briefly, at the Bureau's astral offices on Nooker Street. Aliens, register now.
Okay, got the idea? Good. It seems appropriate more than ever. I remembered that promo. We used to have it on a cart machine, a technology we no longer use, at the station many years ago. And, yeah, you should just throw that in along with, you know, listen to this program at this hour, listen to that program. There's going to be a demonstration here and there. And that would be in the middle. It's from the Fire Sign Theater album. Oh, it's a best of album, actually, is what it is. And I had trouble finding it. I asked online in a Facebook group, as a matter of fact, where I could find it. And lo and behold, it took somebody less than 3 minutes to tell me where it was. And turns out I had the album. It just wasn't called Aliens or PSA Message or anything like that. So there it is. Fire Sign Theater. So, a bit of history about this program, Hour of the Wolf. Hour of the Wolf, if I can talk. I can't talk. I left my glasses at home. I hope I left my glasses at home, because if not, I left them downstairs in the Brooklyn Commons when I was coming in. And that would be more of a hardship on me, since I'm probably not going to be able to make it here tomorrow because of the weather. Hope you're all prepared for that, by the way. You know, get your bread and your water and your milk and stuff like that. You might be socked in for a day or two. Or, after all these warnings, it may not snow. They did that last year. They had all these warnings. Close the schools, stop the subways. Everybody running around going, whaley, 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 whaley. That's a Terry Pratchett reference. And then it didn't, you know, there wasn't even one flake of snow. The only flakes were, in the Weather Bureau. But anyway, 1972, WBAI was not on the air for 24 hours a day in them days. Bob Fass was on from midnight until when he decided to turn off the transmitter. That was usually going to be any time after 3 a.m., sometimes 5:30 a.m. It really depended on the mood, because freeform radio is just that, very, very freeform. Old-time listeners to Robert Knight, Robert and I and a couple of other people are among R. Paul Martin, and I think Rat Mansion as well, are among the last people that are still practicing the form of freeform radio here in WBAI. There are a few people still doing it on WFMU, on WFMU, and I'm so pleased that they still do it there. And there are a few other places. But on BAI, it's not as much. So anyway, people would leave the air when they were ready. Steve Post would try to sign off at 3 a.m., but there would always be a committee of people, usually led by Charles Pitts. Maybe Paul Krasner, if he was around, would get involved, or Marshall Efron, and they would do anything to play the game of let's keep him on the air. Let's prevent him from doing sign-off. I can probably recite sign-off today. And I shouldn't, because there are legal things about that, you know, but it's, you know, it would be at this time WBAI concludes another day of broadcasting. We're at, as Post would put it, we're at X point Y, making these up, X point Y frequency vertical and Y point X frequency horizontal, depending on whether you're standing up or lying down. He did a wonderful sign off. But a news person at BAI, somebody who had worked for Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California, where she was a journalism student and a member of the free speech movement, Margot Adler, she worked for Paul Fisher, who was news director. If you're listening, by the way, hi, Paul. Margot made a deal with the then management of the station, which was basically that, I shouldn't say it all because they were, bending some rules. But it basically came down to the idea that she would forego a salary and take unemployment, but in exchange, he would have to give her own freeform radio show. Now, there were no slots available, and fewer to women. At that point, I think only Liza Cowan and Carol Ratner had done one show was Electra Rewired. I'm trying to remember the name of the other. At any rate, and I shouldn't forget these, because these are great people, good people, still listeners, I hope. At any rate, Adler worked her way. Now, this was not that popular because, A, Larry Josephson wanted to turn on the transmitter at 7 a.m., sharp. And he liked the idea of silence before him. and, you know, coming in cold and starting the day. And I can well understand that. I had to do that a couple of times myself. And it is a joy. It is a complete joy to be able to do that. And also, it meant that fast or post had to go till 5 a.m. They couldn't get off earlier, and they couldn't, in theory, stay later. But thus, the time slot was created. Hour of the Wolf was Mondays through Fridays, 5 to 7 a.m. And 5 to 8:30 a.m. was Gary Fried doing a great music program called The Morning After the Night Before. And I have some other stories, one of which I may tell you a little bit later, about Margot and Gary and me and Star Wars. But that's a whole other, actually not that other a story, but I don't want to digress myself too much. I do that way too much as it is. So anyway, Margot had guest hosts, filling 10 hours a week, 2 hours a day. 5 a.m. would be indeed very, very, very quiet radio, but 6 a.m. starts being prime time. By 6:30 a.m., this joint is jumping, you know, and we had a huge listenership that hour, and she did some of the most fantastic radio I had ever heard. On Monday, she occasionally had as a co-host Mike Hodel, who was in the news department and later on went out to KPFK, our LA station, and became the news director there. He also started a science fiction program there called Hour 25, which still exists from some other people as a podcast. It's no longer Mike because Mike died, late 70s or something, just way too young, way too young. He was not 50 years old. And I don't recall what it was, a brain hemorrhage or something. Like Terry Carr, an editor who died young, they say, you know, his body was just not built to last. And also Neil Conan was another occasional co-host on Monday mornings. He was, I think, the first of the WBAI people to go and create NPR's news department with All Things Considered and Morning Edition. And he's still occasionally, he's retired from NPR only recently, but still can be heard on the air there. Eventually, Margot went to NPR and became a top journalist. She uses the word correspondent. And on Thursdays and Fridays, I was her co-host. I was her engineer many of those days. Not all, but many. And if I wasn't engineering her, I was either at the station, which was in those days in a former church, or at home. I always heard the show. I heard every episode. So, Thursdays and Fridays, she deemed the science fiction mornings. In fact, it would be the Thursday morning science fiction extravaganza or the Friday morning blah, blah, blah. In 1973, I could have sworn it was 74, but I found out from a classmate of hers, she went to a class. She went to the Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop, which is the workshop. There are other good workshops where people hone their skills and become science fiction writers. But Clarion is the longest-lived one. It was either first held in Pennsylvania, then went to the University of Michigan. And a few people, a few of the instructors, created sort of a splinter group and formed what later became called Clarion West. Some people called it the Lost Clarion because they didn't have one the next year, and people weren't sure of it. At any rate, I had a choice. I was also accepted into that same Clarion class. But it's 6 weeks long. It costs money to travel to Seattle and back and to stay somewhere for 6 weeks, and I could not afford that. I was just a full-time teenage WBAI at that time, he said, volunteer. Now I say, I'm an unpaid staff member. Thank you very much. So, she went away for 6 weeks. I did her show for 6 weeks. And when she came back, she resumed doing the show for a while, but then she got a different time slot. And I sort of inherited Hour of the Wolf. You're not supposed to inherit shows. You don't own your time slot. You become established, yes, but you don't own it. It belongs to WBAI, and WBAI gets it in the grace of the Federal Communications Commission, which holds it in a public trust, is actually the legal definition. Broadcast licenses are owned by the people of the United States in a public trust for what they do, and therefore they are given license to broadcast. So, I became the host of Hour of the Wolf. It didn't take long to realize that I didn't have the same depth that Adler had. Adler was just, you know, magnificent. I'm okay. But she was magnificent. She was a journalist. She was one of the first. She was in the second group of the Venice Ramos Brigade, which were the first journalists to go to Cuba. I think they went to Canada and from there went to Havana. And they were there for a few weeks. She was, as I said, a member of the Berkeley Free Speech Movement. In her background, her grandfather is one of the creators of individual psychology. You've heard of Freud, Adler, and Jung. That's Margot's grandfather, Alfred Adler. Her father was Kurt Adler, who, as I like to put it, invented the 50-minute hour. You pay your shrink 50, you know, for an hour, but you get 50 minutes. And her father helped pioneer that with a few other people. So she had a fascinating background. I don't know that much about her mother, but her mother was apparent, and stepmother were both apparently fascinating people. And, well, I can go on and on and on about Adler, and I will on other occasions. But I'm making this a celebration of Hour of the Wolf, because when did the show start? Well, I don't know the exact date. But going through the old folios, which can be found in PDF format at archive.org, and some of the ones that I have in the basement of my house, the first citation I can find was actually the first week of February. But the show was, in fact, on the air before that. It started somewhere in January of 1972. Mid-January, I would say. Mid to late January. So, knowing that by February of 72, we were on the air, this is the 45th anniversary of Hour of the Wolf. I hereby decree it. I hereby state it. And it's for that reason, but I'll give you more reasons, that you should call and pledge 516-620-3602. But I'll give you more reasons. Number one. Oh, just to continue the history a little. Other people, Joan Hervey, Richard Fioravanti, I think for a while Steve Finkelstein. There was at least one other person. I'm really sorry if I'm forgetting your name. Took over Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. I maintained Thursdays and Fridays, and eventually was whittled down by program director Marnie Mueller to just Thursdays, and then moved to just Fridays. And then in the early 80s, Steve Erickson, program director, moved me to Saturday mornings, where I went kicking and screaming. I did not want Saturdays. Monday through Friday are drive time. And he told me, go to a commercial station and ask for their rate cards. It's like, okay, it's a weird thing, but okay. I went to as a matter of fact, WNEW-FM. And I asked for a rate card, and I found out that, indeed, radio commercials cost the same on Saturday morning as they do on Friday morning. And in fact, 6 a.m. Saturday morning, primetime radio. Now, only problem is that by that time, Simon Lokely had created a wonderful show called Why the Revolution Hadn't Come from 5 to 8:30 a.m. Gary Freed, by that time, had moved out of town for a while to try to come back into New York as a successful DJ, but he died of AIDS before he could make it back. It was, to me and a lot of other people, traumatic. Lokely took over that time slot. Lokely, who died, a year and some months ago of cancer. And he was on from 5 to 8:30. And he was like really cool, best friends of Steve Erickson's. Well, Erickson cut his show in half. Gave me the 5 to 7 a.m. portion of it and gave Lokely the 7 to 8:30 portion of it. And you know what? It worked. It just freaking worked. Very, very well. Now, I'm doing what some people consider lowbrow literature, and Lokely was doing highbrow literature, but it was great. Then, October, 6 years ago, my show, Hour of the Wolf, was in essence canceled. And I was brought back about 3 weeks later. I was told by the then program director, Tony Bates, who is the now program manager, I did the very last show with Adler. And Tony said, and I did a very, an upbeat show. I said, I'm going to be back. Don't know where, don't know when I'm going to be back. And Tony came to me looking rather surprised. He said, I understand you did a very, very upbeat show there. I said, yeah. So he gave me another time slot. He gave me Wednesday mornings. And Robert Knight had been on Wednesday nights from midnight till 2 or 3, depending on the era, forever. And did really cool freeform radio with it. And at that point, Gary was midnight to 2 a.m., people's time slots. I mean, I used to have a five-hour time slot, that, as did Bob Fass, as did Steve Post. That just doesn't exist anymore. The most anybody has is 3 hours, I believe. Robert, out of sincere kindness, gave me half an hour of his time. So I was then on from 1:30 till 3 a.m. And it's been that way for about 6 years now, but there is, as of today, as of now, there's a programming change. It's not really a permanent programming change yet, because this is fund drive, but this is what it will be. Kathy Davis and Paulette Spencer will be on, I believe, Monday afternoons. I'm not positive about Paulette. She deserves to be somewhere, let me tell you, because somehow the spirit of Robert Knight Radio needs to continue to be on our air. But Kathy will be on a program there. The show Health Action is being moved to midnight and will be on from midnight to 1, and then I will be on the air from 1 till 3. And I got to tell you, this pleases me. Number one, it gives me a two-hour show, so I can fumfer on the air like I am now, or play some music, or just be a little more relaxed, even with guests. And I'm used to the two-hour form. I still am. I wouldn't mind a three-hour form, but that's another story. Not going to happen. 2 hours is nice, and also just saying to people, when are you on the air? I'm on at 1. Sounds a lot better than I'm on at 1:30. It's really a difference. It's like, how much is that book? It's $13 or it's $12.95. Well, there's only a nickel's difference. But it really sounds different, doesn't it? So I saw the station manager last night as we had the New York Review of Science Fiction reading downstairs at the Brooklyn Commons. And he said, so you like the new time? You're half hour back, huh? Yep, I do. Thank you. So when this fund drive is, I'll probably be, I know I'm on next week. And my guest, by the way, will be Ellen Datlow. And we'll have a very cool premium then. We'll have 5 of her latest book for a very reasonable donation. And after that, I'm probably preempted for the third week of the drive. Fourth week, we don't know yet. My guess is I'll be preempted, because this isn't a huge moneymaker, this program, although you can fix that. And then, assuming this fund drive ends March 6th, which would be a Tuesday night, then as of that Wednesday, Wednesday is March 7th. To me, this is Wednesday. I woke up Wednesday. I worked Wednesday. I know the clock says it's Thursday. But if you're listening on the internet right now in the West Coast, it's 10:30. Wednesday. Get used to it. We have to think in different terms now of what the hours, because this is, after all, not only a radio program, but it's also a podcast in a way, because you can get the RSS feed and it's available on demand, and we're over the world through the internet. So it's Wednesday night, Thursday morning, 1 to 3 a.m. And as I said, celebrating our 45th year. And in order to do that, we have a very, very, very cool premium. To me, it's very, very cool because it's something that I done all these years on the air, interviewing science fiction and fantasy writers who are going to be so important now. You know what one of the best-selling books is since what's-his-name became president of the United States? A famous, great science fiction novel, 1984. Yeah, I hear people saying, that's not science fiction, that's literature. Wrong! Who says that they can't be both? How's it that Samuel R. Delaney or Ursula K. Le Guin or, oh my God, why am I blanking on the name of a great famous Canadian woman who for a while denied that she wrote science fiction? She wrote The Handmaid's Tale and all that. Well, Handmaid's Tale's an example of great science fiction. Jonathan Lethem writes science fiction. Thomas Pynchon writes science fiction. Because don't tell me in Gravity's Rainbow, where the sun goes nova on page one, that that's not apocalyptic science fiction, folks. And there is so much dystopian science fiction out there. And that is going to have a lot to do with how we deal with the resistance that we all feel to what is going on in this country, even to those people who voted for Voldemort. They're going to be resisting before long. I don't think they quite understood what they were getting. It wasn't what they thought they were getting. I'll tell you that. So, yeah, they're calling this the Resistance Fund Drive, and I find that irresistible. So there. So after all these years of interviews, I also, for very low pay, I work for Lightspeed magazine. I say for low pay, for pay, but I don't want people to get the wrong idea. If you took the hours that I work and put them together, it ain't half of minimum wage, okay? But I love it. I enjoy it. Over here, I'm unpaid, so to me, that's a big deal. And because I'm working on Lightspeed magazine, where Skyboat Media, Stefan Rudnicki and Gabrielle DeCure, either themselves read or hire other professional narrators of audiobooks, I'm getting to work with some of the best people out there. And as a favor to me, through their distribution channel, which is Blackstone Audio, they created a CD of interviews from Hour of the Wolf. It is called Chatting Science Fiction. Selected interviews of Hour of the Wolf, produced and hosted by Jim Freund. That's wrong. It's produced by Jim Freund, and I conduct the interviews, but it's actually hosted by Stefan Rudnicki, because he's the one who comes on. Actually, I could play this and should play this, but I don't have it queued up. Can I do that? And I transferred everything to 128 gig hard drive. Here we go. Chatting science fiction. There's continuity. I want to have to open this up. Oh, yes. Is this the unedited version? Let's give it a listen, shall we? Come on. Yep, it's the unedited version. There he is. Is this the edited one?
Skyboat Media, in association with Jim Freund, presents Chatting Science Fiction. Selected interviews from Hour of the Wolf. Featuring interviews with Ursula K. Le Guin, Kim Stanley Robinson, Samuel R. Delaney, Cory Doctorow, Ray Bradbury, Nalo Hopkinson, Peter S. Beagle, China Mieville, Orson Scott Card, Lucius Shepard, Nancy Kress, Ken Liu, Charlie Jane Anders, Genevieve Valentine, Susanna Clark, and Connie Willis. This concludes the
program. You see, that's the unedited. See, it's then my job to go and edit that and put that together and, you know, put the this concludes and make it a proper CD, which it came out. I am so pleased with it. I will have to find... Oh, here we are. Titles and introduction. This has the actual introduction.
Skyboat Media, in association with Jim Fen Liu, Charlie J. Program, Chatting Science Fiction. Selected interviews from our Bradbury, Nalo Hop...
No. Where's the intro?
This audiobook is continued on disc 2.
Nope.
Hi, this is Stefan Rudnicki.
Ah, here we go.
The people who create the ideas that drive science fiction and fantasy.
Nope.
Greetings.
Nope.
This
nope.
is Stefan.
Nope. That's. I'll play it for you some other time. That's a retake, okay? But I was talking about somebody who has a voice. Is that a voice? Stefan is one of the greats, and he made this CD possible. It is produced by moi, Hour of the Wolf Productions, because it's my interviews, but it's really produced by Skyboat Media, because they said, let's put this together, and Blackstone Audio are the people who published a 13-CD set, but it's also available for download. Aha, says you. Download, gee. Does that mean that I could get a copy with all of those interviews with Le Guin and Stan Robinson and Chip Delaney, Nalo Hopkinson, Ray Bradbury? Yep. If you donate $45 to WBAI before 3 a.m., indeed, you can get a download version of this. What you're actually going to get after you pay your pledge is we will be notified and we will in turn pass your information over to Blackstone Audio, who in turn will email you a credit, one credit, which means that you may download one item on their website at downpour.com. Which has a lot of stuff, but you don't want any of that really good stuff they put out. You want mine. You want Chatting Science Fiction interviews from Hour of the Wolf. That's what you want. That's what your $45 donation to WBAI will get you as a gift. Thank you, Blackstone Audio and Downpour.com and Skyboat Media for doing this. And what you do to get it is you call. Area code 516-620-360. Didn't bring my glasses. 2. I hope I left them at home. I hope they're not downstairs locked away. 516-620-3602 is the phone number to call and pledge to WBAI. We are listener-sponsored radio. I told you this whole bizarre, sordid history of WBAI, of Hour of the Wolf, in its 45th anniversary, so that you can pledge and support the station, and more importantly, support the show that has just been granted an additional half hour. Show them that that means something to you. Pledge. Area code 516-620-3602. 2. And, oh yes, you can also go online. And you can click. You can type in to your browser, give to WBAI.org. Org as in like ARG, but it's not ARG, it's ORG, O-R-G, organization. WBAI.org. And in fact, you can just go to WBAI.org, but then you have to do a lot of clicking to where you find, you know, pledge for this, pledge for that. Find the premium you want. Well, the premium you want is called Chatting Science Fiction. When you call 516-620-3602 and pledge a minimum of $45, I'm not stopping you from pledging more. In fact, I'm not stopping you from buying, oh, 5 copies in the previous show. They said, if you're well healed. Well, I'm going to be different from them. They said, that's if you're well healed. I'm going to say, if you're well sold. S-O-L-E-D. And if your soul is good. 516-620-3602 or give to WBAI.org and ask for or click upon Chatting Science Fiction, and you will get about 18 and a half hours on an MP3 download of these interviews with many of the greats of science fiction. I can play one of those interviews for you in the time that we have, if I know that we have money coming in. And you know, hey, Matt, I know Matt from our subscriptions department is here, and he knows how to tell if there is money coming in. I do not. I have never quite figured out the automated, there are no volunteers in the room method. I used to like to go, you know, into the room where the people answering the phones were and saying, any calls coming in? I used to be able to actually open up a mic in that room, and I could talk to the tally, the person who was being functional in that room, and find out, is this, let's see, no, that's, yeah, you know, I'm not seeing, I know it's supposed to be open in a browser, and, well, there ain't no browser here, so. We're going to take your word that you're going to pledge. Got that? You're dialing. Right now, I see that you're dialing. I see right through this microphone that you are dialing 516-620-3602 by the diodes of your radio. Does that sound like something from Doctor Strange? By the diodes of Dormammu. By the diodes. I can tell that you're picking up your browser. You're going to give two. You can do the number 2. Or you can do T-O. That works. Oh, people say do the number 2. But somebody at BAI, I suspect our development director, our interim development director, Ms. Katz, made it so that the letters T-O, G-I-V-E-T-O-W-B-A-I.org, give to WBAI.org, pledge $45, better yet, pay for it with a credit or debit card. I don't use credit cards, I use debit cards. And $45, which used to be, by the way, the price of a full subscription to WBAI when I started here. It was not long after I started here, and God help me, 1967, almost 50 years ago, May 1st, 1967, is when I came to answer phones. The subscription rate was $25, and later on they made it that the subscription rate was voluntarily $45, or if you were student, retired, or unemployed, it was $25, and if you were incarcerated, it was free. And how did we know if you were a student, retired, or unemployed? Well, when you called to pledge, you said so. That was it. Take your word for it. So $45 is what used to be the regular rate for pledging to BAI. And please do that. Area code 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. On this next week's premium, which is a book, we're only going to have five copies. This particular offer is...